This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. When Paul Austin and his wife Sally were anticipating their first child, they both felt excited and ready to be parents. Paul was a medical student and Sally was a nurse, so they were familiar with hospitals and newborns. But when their daughter Sarah was born, they quickly discovered that she had Down syndrome, and they were shocked. They struggled with their own doubts and fears, as well as the prejudices of others. And Paul's new memoir, Beautiful Eyes, tells the story. It traces Sarah's life from the day she was born to the present, when she is now living as a young adult, away from her family in a group home. The memoir follows Paul's journey as a father, trying to better understand his daughter, and details the ways in which Sarah has transformed him and the entire family. Paul Austin and his wife, Sarah Summers Austin, join us in the studio now. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be here.
Paul, this is your second memoir, and this style certainly differs a bit from the first. Tell us about it.
The first book was about the way my job as an ER doc almost wrecked my family and was all just personal narrative with no research or background information. The second book, I wanted to have more background information, a little bit of history, a little bit of science, and as well as the through story that our family lived. And so I think that's the main difference.
And Sally, writing process, I understand, was collaborative in the sense that Paul wrote the book, and I understand you read it and had veto power. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. That's true.
Well, tell us about that. I mean, why did he feel the need to have this kind of other set of eyes on this and actually tell you that you could veto it, take parts out?
Mm-hmm. Well, he wanted the freedom to write whatever came up and felt like it would be good for me to then have veto power. But I found very little that I wanted to change. I just feel it's real important to share our experience and in order to hopefully help other folks out there in similar situations. So I really vetoed very little. He just captures, I think, our own process. It probably is different for other people, but our own family's experience captures it very well.
It's a courageous expression in a lot of ways, Paul. I mean, Paul, as I was reading the book, I sort of imagined myself having these feelings in the first place. I think that's what you talked about, Sally, how useful this would be for people in that situation, but how reluctant I would be ever to tell anybody how I was feeling. Would you tell us? I mean, what were you feeling after Sarah was born?
I didn't know what to feel. I didn't register any emotion other than just being stunned and not knowing what to feel. I just had an awareness that I don't know what to feel. And then I felt stricken.
And you expressed some of these feelings in the book very vividly, very candidly, over and over again, this sense. Did that surprise you in a way that you had these feelings, stricken, as you said, that you would have this feeling about a daughter born with a disability?
I think I just never was that in touch with my emotions anyway. Mm-hmm. So not feeling much or not registering my emotions or recognizing them at that time in my life didn't seem out of the ordinary to me. I think that in retrospect, if Paul now could go back to Paul then, I would tell him that it after all wasn't that big a deal. It sure felt like it. And I don't want to minimize the experience of any other parents who are going through whatever disappointment they may have. But any disappointments we have about our children, I think, reflect our own failures of perception. That I think every parent has something about a child they feel disappointed about, but when you start picking at it or pulling that away, I think it has more to do with your own expectations and your own inability to let your children live their own lives.
Mm-hmm. And those expectations, which drive our understanding of, our expectations, as you said, and our sense of what is normal, is all crafted and reinforced by language. You found yourself struggling with the language, the nomenclature of disability right from the start.
Yeah. I mean, the obvious thing is mental retardation. When we were coming up, that was the accepted medical nomenclature, and it was not necessarily used as a word of scorn or disrespect, but it's become, retarded has become a very hateful word and very hurtful word. Another more fundamental issue I have with language is the word normal, that an EKG can be normal or abnormal. If it's abnormal, we take you to the cath lab and fix your heart. A chest x-ray can be normal or abnormal. If it's abnormal with a pneumothorax, we put a chest tube in it. If it's abnormal with a pneumonia, we give you antibiotics. But when you talk about humans, people being normal or abnormal, then I think you're on shaky ground. I don't think it's a binary system. I don't think it's a light switch on or off. I think and ability and disability, those are two words that on initial inspection, it seems to make sense. But I think we're all on a spectrum, and we're all on a gradient. And the degree to which we try to divide ourselves into two groups, normal, abnormal, or abled, disabled, and draw some arbitrary line to make our world seem to make more sense, I think that's an illusion, and I think that it divides us. And we are better able to live and love our fellow persons and our that sounds so stupid, fellow persons. We can love our family members better if we don't try to divide them between normal and abnormal.
It's but it doesn't sound stupid because it's a struggle for us to get that, to get our heads around that. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're reflecting here beautifully, and you do in the book, is that it is a struggle. We all know how we're supposed to feel. We're supposed to feel when this child comes into the world. This is my child, and I don't care what anybody says. And we don't feel that way because there's a world out there that's told you there's a normal and an abnormal, and there's a lot of things that you're going to have to go through now, and this child is going to have to go through now. So the Paul who has come to that understanding now is speaking to us. Tell us what your fears were at the moment and what it was you were looking at before you had gone through this journey and come to your understanding today.
I was afraid I was going to be responsible for the rest of my life, that I was never going to be off the hook, that I was going to have to take care of somebody till I was like 90. I'd be in a wheelchair and rolling down some hallway and I'd have this responsibility.
Sally, there's a few scenes in this book, passages that describe where the two of you differed about how to move forward in parenting. Mm-hmm. Tell us about those disagreements you had.
When Sarah was little, she started learning sign language at about 2 years old. She wasn't developing language. That's one of the deficits of children with Down syndrome, is they have difficulty with their mouth muscles. And so they learned sign language, which I found very helpful. And Paul was less enthusiastic about sign language. I was with her primarily, so it just really helped me to know what she was thinking, and I had the sense watching her and watching her eyes that she was thinking a lot. She was taking in just all of her environment, and so it was really helpful to me. And she learned sign language quickly and well, and so that was really encouraging. She did start talking at about 5 years old, and really does a real good job verbally today. Then the other thing too was that she developed, she didn't walk until she was also, I guess, about 4 years old. And so with her early intervention nursery school, she started using a walker, and that was another thing that Paul and I sort of disagreed about, but it was just great to see her up and moving on her feet. And
you thought she should.
Yes, I thought I was glad for her to use the walker.
I want to talk about those disagreements in a minute, but it occurs to me, Paul, I'm asking you your reflections, how you felt about all this. It's your memoir, and these are your reflections in the book. But Sally, you're here. Mm-hmm. What did you think when Sarah was born? What was going through your mind?
I had worked with children with Down syndrome in surgical ICU after heart repair. And so I knew a little bit about Down syndrome, and was was pretty overwhelmed immediately, but our obstetrician was really wonderful, and he said she is going to be more like other children than not. And the first year she will be primarily an infant and a baby, and she was just a great baby. So I think I pretty quickly got over the initial fears.
Paul, let me ask you about those disagreements, sign language and a walker. Sally thought both would be a good idea. You initially thought you opposed that. Why?
I was stupid.
Well, tell me what was going through your stupid mind at the time.
I said, we can't teach her sign language, baby. She'll look deaf. And we can't let her use a walker. She'll look like she's crippled. And I'm embarrassed to say that now, but that's what I felt, and that's what I said. And to Sally's credit, she stood up to me, and to my credit, I was convincible, stupid but easily led, and been married 30 years, best decision I ever made.
It's one of the hallmarks of stupidity, Paul, so you can be proud of that. Easily led. Not easily led. Let me talk to you about that, because, again, these are critical issues. You have a daughter. You're trying to raise her. This sends a lot of parents into marriage counseling, and now this is an even more difficult situation. Were you easily led, or what was happening to you internally in terms of all of these templates about normal and abnormal? I mean, look at the other things you're saying. Well, she's crippled. She's going to be, oh, my goodness, what am I imposing on this girl?
And one thing the OB doc told us was to go to a marriage counselor early on. All parents, he suggested, should. Parents of children with special needs particularly, and we did that. And I was on a ward as a third-year med student, pediatric ward, and there was a child with cancer, bald-headed kid walking down the hallway holding one hand. He was holding his mother's hand. The other hand, he was holding an IV pole. And I asked the attending physician, like the boss doc, I said, how do the parents do it? And he said, the weaker couples split up and the stronger couples get stronger. And that really stuck to my brain and stuck in my mind. And when Sarah was born, Sally and I made a conscious decision to do whatever it takes to be one of the couples that stays stronger. And in that respect, I was easily led. But the context was I was working as a resident physician, first year as an intern, second year as a second year resident, and working in an environment, didn't get a lot of sleep. A lot of the people at work were in various stages of illness. And so I think that context also made it harder for me to keep an open mind at home.
Well, and this is certainly your personal reflection through all of this, but you also incorporated a lot of history and how the thinking about people with disabilities has changed over time. Tell us what you found most striking in that search.
The first record of a child born with atypical features is in the clay tablets of Mesopotamia, cuneiform writing. And they were seen as portents, that if a child is born with ambiguous genitalia, then the kingdom will suffer such and such a calamity. I don't know what the specific atypical features correlated with what outcome. But from the very beginning, we started writing down words that's been, it was thought to be a portent, thought to mean something, thought to be God giving us messages. The term monster is from monstere, or some Latin word for premonition, and that was applied to children who had features that seemed atypical. And so from the very beginning of language, we've divided people into two groups, which are normal and not normal, and I think that's limited our ability to have true perceptions.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating that from the beginning of language, we were able to make those kinds of distinctions about disability, mm-hmm. both of which are rooted in the word die, which means to, the separation. Those kind of human beings were coming into the world long before language. And so if anyone wants to know about what creation thought, it should look at what it had been doing from the beginning of time before words. So you make the point very well. But let's talk about what happens now when Sarah. Sarah's read the book, right?
Yeah, she read the book and her feelings were hurt. And we've talked about it a couple of times, and she thought the book had too much Down syndrome in it and wanted more happy stories. And turns out my editor felt the same way. And so I was going to the movies with Sarah, and I said, Sarah, I went all the way up to New York to talk to my editor about my book. And she just told me the same thing you did. And she laughed and slapped her thigh and said, yeah, I told you so, Dad. And I said, I need some happy stories because I can't get the second half of my advance. I need to get some happy stories to get the rest of my money. She said, good luck with that, Dad. You were always working. Mom was always stressed. And so I was so glad to hear her express that so succinctly and so clearly that she got it. And she kind of forgave Sally and me for our failures as parents. And I think overall we did pretty well. Sarah's a vibrant, funny, insightful, well-adjusted human, and we get some credit for it.
She picked up on some of the descriptions that you made, particularly early on, those first feelings that you had. You also talked about John Locke's distinction mm-hmm. in there, and she really latched onto those and was pretty upset, wasn't she?
Yes, she was. And there's a scene in the book where I'm reading John Locke, and he's used the ability to have abstract thought as the cleavage plane between beasts and humans. And I disagreed with him to such a degree that I wrote a sentence, the very percussive sentence with a lot of K's in it, about how vehemently I disagree with John Locke. And I don't know, I can't quote it on the air. So
you used an F word to describe how you felt about it. You asked her what it meant. She told you what it meant.
Right.
Those are the words you can't say.
Right.
But she got it.
And yeah, and she got it. And yeah. And she still disagrees with John Locke. We were at the movies waiting for a movie to start. And she goes, what's that guy's name who thinks that people with disabilities aren't quite human? I said, John Locke. But that's kind of oversimplification. And she goes, yeah, I still don't like the guy.
Would that he had understood that compassion is also an essential human quality right. and separates us from something, or at least separates some humans from others. It would have been a different outcome. So how do you feel now about having written the book? I mean, now that it's out and in the big wide world, has it changed you much just having gone through that process?
Yeah. It's I'm glad the book's out. I'm glad it seems to be doing fairly well. But it was only in the process of writing the book that I came to see Sarah as she is, as clearly as I can see her. That I was in a writer's workshop, and they had us cut the text into little pieces and spread it out to just look at the words in a spatial fashion. It was a poet, was a guy teaching it. And I thought it was a little bit precious, the idea, but I decided to go along with the program and do it. And they let us put pictures in the mix to look at our work. And I had an 8x10 photograph of her karyotype, her chromosomes all lined up. And I had that on one part of the table. And then I had a photograph of her, a little 3x5 picture of her in a Halloween costume or sitting in the group home. And I thought, this picture looks so small. And then I looked at the chromosome picture, and this picture looks so big. And just that physical fact of the size of these photographs, how big her chromosomal reality loomed in my consciousness, and how small the reality of her as a person was represented in my consciousness. And I just burst out crying. I had to leave and ended up interrupting another workshop, screaming and wailing in the woods. But
Well, I'm glad that on the way you were able to write this book. Thank you both so much for being on the program. Paul Austin and wife Sally Summers Austin talking about Paul's new memoir, Beautiful Eyes. Paul's going to be reading from Beautiful Eyes with his daughter, Sarah, at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham next Wednesday, November 5th. And you can find out more details at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next, the Murphy School Radio Show. We will get a preview on the State of Things. Stay tuned.